Ladies and gentlemen, good day and welcome to today's webinar where we will discuss the Antrix Devas arbitrations as well as takeaways for the Indian government from an investment arbitration standpoint. We have with us today Mr. Vyapak Desai, Partner, Head of International Litigation and Dispute Resolution Practice, Niyati Gandhi and Durga Priya Manda, Members, International Litigation and Dispute Resolution Team. As a reminder, all participant lines will be in the listen-only mode and there will be an opportunity for you to ask questions after the presentation concludes. Should you need assistance during the conference call, please signal an operator by pressing star then zero on your touchtone phone. Please note that this conference is being recorded. I now hand the conference over to Mr. Vyapak Desai. Thank you and over to you, sir.
Thank you and thanks everyone to join this conference. There are a few people here in presence at our Nariman Point office and we have quite a few people joined on the phone. So thank you everyone to make time to attend this webinar. I also have my colleagues Niyati Gandhi and Durga, who are part of our International Litigation Dispute Resolution Team, who would join me to give a little brief on what we want to discuss today regarding the Devas Antrix dispute, where recently India faced an at least a liability award saying that India did not adhere to some of the obligations under the investment treaties that it has signed with the country from which this investment had happened. So taking a little step back, and the reason why we thought this topic may be relevant for discussions is obviously the thrust of the new government since they have taken over for last about 2 years of making India as one of the most preferred destinations for foreign investments and bringing India as one of the preferred countries for ease of doing business by several different initiatives, including Make in India and you know, bringing on several different legislations and regulations to ease off all the hurdles which the foreign investor were facing for last few years. Now, with that background, it becomes very important to understand what kind of rights and what kind of relationships the foreign investors would share with India, particularly with the background of the bilateral investment treaties and the comprehensive trade agreements which India has entered into with several countries since 1990s. So there are about more than 70 such agreements and some of them are under considerations and negotiations which India has gone ahead and entered into, basically protecting the investors both ways and giving certain obligations to the state in behaving and taking actions or not taking actions in a particular way to ensure that the investments of the foreign investors coming from those countries are duly protected. In spite of the fact that this regime and the agreements have been entered since 1990s, I would say that this topic was not very relevant almost till about 2012, because there was only one instance which was the case regarding the Enron investment in India, which came up and touched upon the areas of investment treaty claims. That too largely got settled, so we don't have too much of jurisprudence with that regard till 2012. But what happened post 2012 is dramatic. We got one award against us, though it was on the basis that there was not enough judicial support for enforcement of a commercial award which was pending enforcement in India for more than 10 years for an Australian company against a state agency in India. I think that invoked a lot of excitement, I would say, so far as this topic is concerned, and as to what investment treaty claims can bring to table for the foreign investors. What followed thereafter is even more striking, because then, of course, everyone knows Vodafone happened. Vodafone is also at the moment currently reportedly in a treaty claim against India. In that period, we saw several licenses related to the 2G spectrum getting cancelled by Supreme Court judgment, which led to several claims against India coming out of bilateral investment treaties. And today, India is facing almost more than 20 notices at different stages of bilateral investment claims. And most of them are in the period between 2014 and 2015, which makes India as one of the leading countries facing such claims in just 1 year. So I think it is definitely something which, as a country, we need to understand and address some of the issues which have come up as part of these claims, and make sure that they align with the large campaign and the endeavors that India is making at the moment for attracting more foreign investment for the growth and development of the country. On the side, there of course was a reaction from the government when they saw so many claims coming under the BIT, and there is a consultation paper and a report already in public domain where India has announced that they may relook at model BIT, that they would be further negotiating with the existing BITs and the new BITs which they may enter upon in the near future. Of course, some of the provisions of this model BIT have been highly criticized, being a knee-jerk reaction. And some of the provisions where they wanted to take away the most favored nation clause, bring in lot of strict carve-outs with regard to the tax claims or certain regulatory challenges, including bringing in the concept of substance requirement as far as the definition of investor and investment is concerned. I think it has been widely debated in the circles, both as practitioners and academicians, and we'll see how that spans out over a period of time. But I think today we are not really touching upon some of those general aspects. The idea today is to go a little deep into the aspect of the Antariksh dispute, which is, in my view, one of the first and a detailed jurisprudence that would possibly develop over a period of time once we see how this enforcement actions and challenges against these awards are going to happen. So just to give you a little background to the dispute, and without taking too much time on the facts, there was an agreement between Devas Multimedia with Antariksh, which is nothing but a commercial arm of ISRO, to lease the S-band transponder capacity for certain two satellites, GSAT-6 and GSAT-6A, which were yet to be launched. The proportion of investments, and to just to get a little idea of what kind of amounts are involved in this dispute, is that ISRO was to build those satellites at a cost of almost $110 million, while the lease rentals to be paid by Devas were about USD 25 million for a period of 12 years. So that was the background under which the agreement was entered upon in 2005. Of course, there was some progress, though very slow, till about 2011, where it appears that it was almost as a surprise that it came to the knowledge by a letter from Antrix that the agreement which was entered for providing these licenses and the facilities to lease the transponder capacity for launching the broadband services in India were annulled. And this was done on the background of a cabinet committee on securities decision that those spectrum were required for certain security reasons for the military use, and therefore they inform that this is in relation to certain security, essential security measures that India has to take, and therefore these are in effect certain force majeure events where this license conditions cannot be met any further, and therefore the contract is terminated. Now, there were few public reports at that point in time, but we have not seen much of the reports talking about any consultative process which might have happened between Devas, Antrix, or the government while taking such a important decision where a huge foreign investment was involved. This led to two separate parallel claims, one under international commercial arbitration, which was purely based on a contractual breach claim on part of Devas, alleging that Antrix has terminated the contract and it's an illegal termination of contract and this is not a valid termination as per the contractual requirement. And the second claim, which came about in 2012 after almost an year of the commercial arbitration starting, which was purely against the state, that is India, on the basis that the decision of the Cabinet Committee on Security, which led to such a termination, is in violation of certain treaty obligations which India has undertaken under the India-Mauritius Treaty. And so broadly, though this both these arbitrations are or were running in parallel, and they are in effect, the cause of action is the CCS decision. They are technically on two different grounds against two different entities under two different claims, one purely on the contractual basis and second on the breach of treaty, which is what the India faced recently. So commercial arbitration ended up with a damage award against Antrix, which was more than $600 million, while the investment treaty claim in September 2015 concluded that yes, there is a breach of the treaty, but the damage liability is yet to be ascertained. At least that's not something that we are aware of at what damages are ultimately granted under that BIT. So what we will do is going forward, we'll break this session into two. Niyati will briefly talk about the commercial arbitration, which concluded in a damage claim, while Durga will take you through a few provisions of the investment treaty provisions, leading to the liability claim which has been assessed against India. And then we will throw open the platform for a few questions and interactions, because that is what possibly will get more value to this session that we thought it would be helpful for the group which has come together today. So over to Niyati, maybe you can just briefly give an idea as to what was this commercial arbitration all about.
Thanks, Vyapak. Hello, ladies and gentlemen. I'm going to very, very briefly go through the commercial arbitration aspects of the Antrix-Devas dispute. Before I begin, I just wanted to say that the Antrix-Devas dispute is interesting mainly because of the amount and the variety of proceedings that have been commenced in a four-year time frame and have yielded various results over the course of those 4 years. So when the agreement was terminated in 2011, it was terminated on account of a Cabinet Committee on Security decision. However, the way it was communicated to Devas was by way of a letter which Antrix had sent terminating the contract. And the letter supposedly states that the agreement between Antrix and Devas was terminated on grounds of force majeure. And this force majeure has happened because it was impossible for Antrix, on account of the Cabinet Committee on Security's decision, to obtain the necessary frequency or the orbital slot coordination and other such technical specifications required by Antrix to be obtained for the completion of this agreement. Now, so essentially the commercial arbitration is only an adjudication upon this claim of force majeure by Devas, and the tribunal was actually constituted under the ICC rules. The request for arbitration was sent under the ICC rules, but the government of India has responded in a very interesting way, where it did not immediately nominate its own arbitrator, but tried to commence parallel arbitration proceedings under the UNCITRAL rules. Now, this had happened because the clause contained in the agreement was also interesting, which gave the option to the parties to either arbitrate under the ICC rules or arbitrate under the UNCITRAL rules. In light of this option, Devas Multimedia tried to commence their arbitration under the ICC rules and appointed an arbitrator, while Antrix, which is the government entity, tried to commence arbitration under the UNCITRAL rules. Now, while this entire appointment process was going on, the Indian entity decided to participate in the ICC proceedings as well and nominated their own arbitrator. However, at the same time, they decided to file Section 11 or appointment proceedings before the Supreme Court of India, asking the Supreme Court to appoint an arbitrator on behalf of Devas Multimedia, which had actually sent the request for arbitration and nominated their own arbitrator. This was actually one of the more arbitration-friendly decisions from the Supreme Court of India, where the court had found that, that there was no necessity for the court to interfere in this arbitration process because both the arbitrators had been appointed and there was no need of the UNCITRAL proceeding to exist at all. So the ICC proceeding went on forward and the tribunal was constituted. The two arbitrators appointed were V.V. Veeder, QC, and Dr. Adarsh Anand on behalf of Antrix, the Indian entity, and together they appointed the chairperson as Dr. Michael Pryles. Now, the tribunal has essentially only assessed whether Antrix had any right to terminate the Devas agreement on grounds of force majeure, and it has assessed whatever evidence was before it in terms of what was there under the CAG report or whatever was presented by the parties during the arbitration proceedings to determine whether there was actually a force majeure event, and if there was a force majeure event, could Antrix have validly terminated the agreement by way of the letter they had sent to Devas Multimedia. Now the award and the news reports about the award, the information that is in the public domain, says that essentially there was no force majeure event that entitled Antrix to validly terminate this agreement. So they are not necessarily saying that there was no force majeure event at all. They are interpreting the force majeure clause in the agreement to say that as per the scope and extent of the force majeure clause in the agreement, there was no force majeure event which would entitle Devas to terminate the contract. And if Devas is not entitled to validly terminate the contract, then it is an illegal termination of the contract or an illegal repudiation, illegal renunciation of the Devas agreement. And therefore, Devas would be entitled to damages. There were possibly questions of impossibility of performance under Section 56 of the Indian Contract Act. However, there isn't enough information available on why the agreement was terminated only on grounds of force majeure and what was the assessment on any contentions of maybe impossibility of performance. finally, what I can, what finally this arbitration has led to damages. These damages are amounting to about 672 million, which include liquidated damages for illegal repudiation or renunciation of the agreement, as well as interest pre-award and post-award. This is broadly what has happened under the commercial arbitration. The only additional pieces of information available in terms of the commercial arbitration is that now there exist proceedings before the Delhi High Court filed by Antrex in challenge of the award that exists. At the same time, there is also Section 9 relief sought by Devas to prevent certain actions by Antrex. However, this proceeding is still underway before the Delhi High Court. Additional information that is available is that there is one other proceeding that is pending before a city civil court in Bangalore. However, because city civil courts are not trial, are not courts of record, there is no information available in terms of what exactly these proceedings are and how the Delhi High Court is treating them. With this, I will hand over to Durga, who will talk to you more in detail about the investment arbitration proceedings in this long-winded Antrex Devas litigation saga. Thanks, Durga. Over to you.
Thank you, Niyati. Hello, everyone. So I will be talking in a little more detail about the investment dispute between Devas and against the Government of India. So just to give you a little background, an investment dispute stems out of the violation of a bilateral investment treaty between, which essentially is signed into between two countries. However, the country will the agreement will still give a private investor the right to initiate proceedings against the country for the violation of certain investment protections granted to it. So this is essentially why you can also have an ICC commercial arbitration running in parallel alongside an investment arbitration, and therefore you can have separate disputes arising from the same set of circumstances as well. Now, having understood what essentially a BIT entails and the different rights and obligations that different countries have vis-a-vis investors of the opposite country, I'll take you slowly through the different provisions of the India-Mauritius BIT. Now, there are various investors to Devas in the present dispute. The Mauritian investors of Devas have initiated proceedings under the India-Mauritius BIT, but again, in public domain, we also know that the Deutsche Telekom, which is another investor of Devas, has threatened to institute proceedings against India under the India-Germany BIT as well. Now, coming to the India-Mauritius BIT, it's a very unique BIT in the sense that when you look at how investment has been defined, there is a slightly diluted threshold of a nationality requirement. Before an investment dispute can actually be admitted into arbitration, you must satisfy the jurisdiction as well as the admissibility phases in a dispute. Therefore, the investor who seeks to claim against the government of a against the government for the violation of any investment protection, any protection guarantee thereof, has to be a national from the other state outside of the host state which hosts the investment. Now, again, within the India-Mauritius BIT, there is no strict requirement of control under the investment treaty. Therefore, by simply being a national investor of Mauritius, an investor can sue India again for violation of the India-Mauritius BIT. Now, coming to the actual definition of investment, which is the substantive scope of investment, if mere influx of money into a company by way of stocks or shares or participation in the affairs of a company would count as investment. Therefore, and Devas, which Devas investors, which had put in money into various projects within India for building up its telecom initiative, would definitely have counted as investment, which is presumably what the tribunal also decided in this case. The investment arbitration was conducted under the aegis of the Permanent Court of Arbitration. Now, moving forward to various protections that are granted under the BIT, I think of most importance are two essential protections, which are the fair and equitable treatment as well as the expropriation claims. Now, it must be noted at this instance that we have to distinguish between Antrix, which is the commercial wing of ISRO, versus the actual respondent in these proceedings, which is the Government of India. Now, we understand that while in the commercial arbitration, Anthrix might have been a party to the contract, and therefore there was a valid claim against Anthrix. Over here, the investment arbitration is filed against India, which would mean that India has violated the investment treaty, and there isn't much question of attributability of Anthrix action to India, as we will see, that the Cabinet Committee on Security was actually the reason, or rather the source of the cause of action for the dispute. Now, moving forward to how fair and equitable treatment as well as expropriation have been defined under the BIT, fair and equitable, a country is obliged to reasonably treat the investment of a foreign investor within its territory so as to ensure that A, if the investor is granted all reasonable rights with respect to how his investment is treated under the country, and also a legitimate expectation that his investment will not be frustrated under the laws of the locals of the host state. Now, coming to the actual dispute, we do know from the facts that the limited facts that are released to us in public domain that Anthrix had suspended its obligations under the contract because of a Cabinet Committee on Security decision mandating that they do so. Now, the Cabinet Committee on Security is the highest authority in India for making security decisions and includes, among other officials, the Prime Minister of India as well as other various high-level government officials, which is why the attributability of CCS's actions to India, the respondent state, is not much of an issue to begin with. Now, it is clear, it is known, the CCS in granting, making its decision, if it were to abide by the fair and equitable treatment standard of behaving unreasonably under the BIT, it must have ensured that at some point that the foreign investors were given a chance to understand how their investment has been treated under the BIT. The main reason for the FET violation, in my opinion, is that the CCS committee never heard the investors, never gave an opportunity to the investors to be heard before the committee before making a decision. It was sort of a sudden notification that the investors received that, you know, their investment, the license that was the basis of their investment and their sort of incentive to even invest in India was cancelled by the CCS. Therefore, the attributability of CCS actions would amount to an FET violation under the treaty. Nevertheless, moving on to the concept of expropriation, again, if the government were to unfairly to make it simpler to understand, would frustrate the foreign investors' investment in a manner which despite having been done for public purposes, would be compensable under the India and Mauritius BIT. So essentially, there is a distinction created under the BIT for, say, if an act done by the state was done for a public purpose, but it yet frustrates the investment of a foreign investor, the country is still liable to pay compensation to the investor. This is to ensure a sort of balance and fairness in foreign investment at the end of the day, because if I have been incentivized to invest in a country, and the country still has the regulatory power and authority over my investment, it should ensure that it gives me fair and equitable compensation for any breach of the investment treaty, which would include an expropriation claim. Now, had the investors even been part of the decision-making process of the CCS in cancelling the S-Spectrum license, perhaps there would not have been an FET violation. However, at the end of the day, the license was still required for Davis to conduct its business in India because it was entering the telecommunications sector, as Vyapak pointed out, to provide internet services. Therefore, the fact that the basis of this investment was itself frustrated by the cancellation of the license would itself indicate that there was a sort of expropriation as required for under the treaty. Now, any bilateral investment treaty would give rights and obligations to both parties involved. Logically, this would mean that a state would still have some regulatory control and authority within the treaty that would not be scrutinized to dispute resolution mechanisms or damages and liability thereof. It's a very nuanced distinction created within the treaty, but then again, one of the reasons that India had given for its conduct of suspending the license was that it was something necessary for military and defense purposes. Now, Article 11 of the Bilateral Investment Treaty says that any, to some extent, creates a carve-out that there would not be a violation of the investment treaty had the action of the state, the respondent, that is India in this matter, had in some way or the other was necessary for, you know, for India's defense and security purposes. Now, again, we are not privy to the arguments that were actually raised within this dispute, but there is a DOS notification, that is a Department of State notification, which says that India's arguments under this particular head say, stating that the license to the spectrum was necessary for India's defense purposes, was ultimately rejected by the tribunal. Now, this leads us into an interesting discussion as to whether or not there is a subjective or an objective requirement for defining what would be an essential security interest at the end of the day. Because if a country had its own subjective right to determine what was its own security interest, then any country would be given the free will to frustrate any foreign investment, and there would not be any fairness in the system at the end of the day. Now, this requirement was clearly diluted because the tribunal, according to the DOS notification, stated that it was not ultimately a defense or that India could have taken at the end. So at the end of the day, a BIT would sort of ensure that there would be a balance of rights between an investor as well as the state. But in this case, it was rather clear from the way that the DOS notification as well as the award against India has come out into the public that India had through the CCS unfairly terminating the license without making the investors part of the decision-making process, and by cancelling the license, which was the basis of a foreign investor's investment in India, had violated the terms of the BIT. Now, in terms of valuing the investment and valuing the liability as well as the damages that are due, the proceedings are still underway. We are unaware of any proceedings. And also, one more analysis that can come out of the treaty would be that any expropriatory conduct, even if done for public purpose, would still be subject to fair and equitable compensation of the investment at its market value. Now, this is to be read in contradistinction with an act of the state which is essential for the protection of its domestic security or further defense purposes, because compensation would not be due under the BIT if the act of the state was essential for protecting its security. However, for a public purpose, yes, even though an act of the state has frustrated the investment, it would still be due compensation for the same. So the treaty creates this distinction, and also the tribunal, we believe, to some extent also agrees with a stringent distinction, because even it would advocate for objective and rational reasons for why a country would require the use of a spectrum license for its own defense and security purposes, rather than merely stating so and getting away with your international obligations under a BIT and by going under this particular head without the expectation of compensation at the end of the day. So I think this would more or less summarize any the most probable claims under the BIT, which would be that of fair and equitable treatment violation as well as expropriation of foreign investment. Now I will hand it over to Vyapak, who will generally take us through any takeaways for the Indian government.
Sure. So I think as we heard from Niyati and Durga, that at the end of the day, I don't think that there may be a real reason to say that there was absolutely no reason to terminate such a contract, because yes, there was a contract for spectrum allocation. Yes, there was a reason for security concerns and why the annulment was required. Yes, there is a specific carve out in no uncertain terms that if that is the reason for taking certain actions amounting to any expropriation, then that will be a carve out from any claims or compensation arising out of it. Interestingly, in fact, unlike other treaties, at least this treaty do not require a further level of proof on necessity for such an action for essential security interests protection. So I think the takeaway or the discussion today is not really as to who is right and who is wrong and whether what was interpreted was correct or otherwise, because a lot of that would depend upon the actual circumstances, the facts, the way the evidence was led, the way the conduct of the parties was appreciated by the tribunal, and a lot of other factors in the process. But what we feel and what we understand is that though there may be certain right or legitimate reasons to take certain decisions like this, what is that government really need to do is to follow the basic principles that whether it is disproportionate or whether it is reasonable and fair to take such a decision in circumstances like this, when you have stringent obligations under the treaties that India has entered upon with several countries, and two, the decision-making process itself as to how fair and transparent that process is involving the affected parties by following the very basic principles of natural justice, as to whether those was followed and whether the decision-making process is just and equitable. Because as Durga was pointing out, that yes, there is a very, very valid defense under the treaty which India could have relied upon, and India did rely upon. But what has not waived possibly for the tribunal is that whether it is, one, proportionate for such a decision to be taken, and whether it was just and equitable for such a decision to be taken, which amounts to an expropriation, in spite of the fact that this may be for a public purpose. So I think if we summarize our thought process on this and how this will evolve over a period of time, and possibly the lessons that any government should take, is that some of these obligations need to be taken seriously, and I'm sure government has taken and will take seriously going forward. But I think it is even more important as to how do we implement the decision-making process, which will possibly affect the final outcome. And the tribunal may have come with a very different decision in spite of the fact that it might have amount to expropriation, but yet if it was proportionate to the reasons for such an decision, if there was possible evidence given or possible reasons given for as to why such decision was necessary to take for the purpose of protection of essential security interest, then we might have seen a different result. And similarly for several other pending arbitrations or pending decisions, I think this is definitely something that will go a long way in terms of the conduct, particularly for taking such decisions and dealing with the foreign investors in particular for the protection of their treaty claims. So with that, we'll be happy to open up the floor for taking any comments, questions, anything that the participants would want to add to this discussions or have any, you know, queries for.
Sure, thank you very much. We will now begin the question and answer session. Anyone who wishes to ask a question or make any comments may press star and one. If you wish to remove yourself from the question queue, you may press star and two. Participants are requested to only use handsets while asking a question. Ladies and gentlemen, we will wait for a moment while the question queue assembles.
So maybe we'll wait for a minute or two for questions from people who are on the phone.
Sure.
And if there are not many coming through, then we do have some questions from the audience who is physically sitting here. So maybe we can just wait so that people who are on the phone gets a little chance to participate in this discussion.
Sure, absolutely. Participants who wish to ask questions or make comments, press star and one. Anyone who wishes to ask a question or speak can press star and one on their touchtone telephone.
Till the time those questions queue up, maybe we can take one question at least from you. You can say that. It would be audible if you speak a little louder. You have mics up there.
So we discussed and we read about the fact that the decision of the tribunal in both the decisions in this particular matter were against India, and even though security is a big concern, still it was not considered to be proportionate and just and equitable to invalidate the agreement per se. So as far as I read about this agreement, there was also a political element, domestic political element involved in this particular issue, where when the actual agreement was signed, there were certain irregularities that were there, the proper procedure was not followed, and that is why somewhere around the 2G scam regime, this is where this thing happened, and a lot of political element was also involved because of which India per se did not fulfill their obligation to this particular treaty and to this particular agreement. And that is, and I wanted to understand that could that, because we do not know what the rationale of the court was over there, but could that be also a reason for the court to decide against India? Because somewhere or the other, everybody of us knew that there was some political influence there, which turned out to be an imbalance later.
Sure. Just maybe I can take it first, and Durga or Niyati, you can add. But I think first point is it was both the decisions are not against India in that sense, because one is against India, the other is against the entity Antariksh.
Yes.
So obviously these are, as we explained, that though it stems out of the decision to terminate, based on CCS decision asking the Antariksh to terminate. But these are two different decisions, completely on two different interpretation. One is purely a contractual interpretation between two private parties, and second is purely on the interpretation of treaty breach by India so far as the foreign investor is concerned. Now, coming to the political angle to this, and particularly whether at the time of entering into contract were there any irregularities which led India to take such a decision. Now, again, I don't know whether that was one of the grounds or one of the many grounds which waived for taking such a decision. But in our view, that may not be as relevant as the decision itself. Because at the end of the day, it is the decision to annul the contract which is under question and the circumstances surrounding annulment of the contract. So irrespective of what went into entering into the contract, right, if the procedure and the reasoning for termination or the annulment of contract vis-a-vis Antariksh under the contract, vis-a-vis India under the treaty were valid, right, then it would have been still come in the favor of India. But possibly the connection between these two maybe is that since it was to start with not a contract that India or Antariksh would have entered into for different reasons, that they were annulling the contract on possibly a valid ground of security concerns, but not proportionate to the extent of annulling the contract. So that may have waived in terms of the arguments that was this the only ground or was there something beyond security? Because if one could have established that this was purely for security reasons, looking at the language of treaty at least, there is no doubt that that can be a valid ground. So it is possibly that there was not enough reasons justifiable, proportionate to the action of annulment, and that would have led to this. Of course, there is enough in the public sources leading to even a corruption trial against the people who were involved at the time of entering into the contract and several other things. So that may be still, in my view, third leg of the Devasantrix saga, which may possibly analyze at some point in time. But I think these two arbitrations at least were particularly specifically in relation to the termination and not much with regard to how it worked.
Seems to me quite possible that one could be in breach of the contract and the government of India is still not in breach of its treaty obligations.
Yes.
If the contractual issue is totally one.
Sorry to interrupt, but we can't hear the question.
Sorry, you can be a little louder.
The contractual issue is totally one of interpretation to do with whether or not the act of state comes within the force majeure, whereas the treaty obligation is a much more difficult issue. And I think you're both suggesting that legitimate expectations and natural justice rules are relevant to the fair and equitable treatment obligation. Now, whilst I understand that, it seems to me that a legitimate expectation can only arise from something that has been put in place beforehand. So if I take an example, for example, of a nuclear test, let's say a particular bit of desert has been conceded to a particular company for mining of minerals. That is the only place where a country could perform a nuclear test without endangering its population. So it decides to conduct that nuclear test in that area, subjecting it to radiation for the future, making it unmineable, and as a result, the concession is cancelled. Now, in those circumstances, could the investor really be held to have a legitimate expectation to be consulted on whether or not that particular test site is an appropriate test site for that state? My own view is that arguably it couldn't, because there's no duty on the state to consult as such. And if it is genuinely in its national security interest, that it conduct this test.
You are right, and therefore I think what we said is that so far as expropriation claim is concerned, right, as to whether this was required or necessary for essential security interest, and if it was possibly proved that this was the only and the relevant reason and proportionate to such a decision being made, possibly at least that claim would have not resulted into any compensation. Then comes your fair and equitable, because it cannot stand on its own if this this was not fulfilled as an obligation for the purposes of expropriation. So so if India can possibly now at the time of challenge or at the time when it was being argued, justify their reasons for taking such a decision purely on the basis of security concerns, then maybe all of this may not have happened the way it has happened. But I think everything stems out of the fact that whether the kind of decision it was taken and the way it was taken, whether it is reasonable and justified. So I think to some extent they are interlinked. And to start with, it starts with the expropriation claim leading up to an FET rather than the other way around.
And just to add to that very briefly, so the ICC arbitration, so I think your initial question was with respect to whether there was an umbrella clause within the investment treaty and whether a contractual dispute could be heightened to a treaty claim. So in our opinion, I think the commercial arbitration initially was a private dispute between a commercial entity and Divas, whereas the investment claim was with respect to CCS's own handling of the foreign investment and therefore why that was not done in a manner consistent with India's own obligations under the treaty. So in creating that distinction as well, and alongside that adding a certain rationale and objective criterion to understanding how a security exception would work in favor of a state, is something I believe should be a little bit more elaborated upon when the Indian government is to consider foreign investments in the future.
No, I completely understand that. It does seem to me that a lot of these investment treaty tribunals are arguably overstepping their mark and their mandate, because there's been a lot of criticism, particularly about South American countries, for investment treaty tribunals being too investor-friendly and for not taking into account the legitimate interests of the state in regulating its own affairs, environmental matters, defense matters, and so on. And this seems to be another example of that happening. And it's just slightly surprising, obviously it's unfortunate for India, that if there's a genuine need for this spectrum for military purposes, then you would have thought that would be sufficient to defeat any kind of claim under the investment treaty.
Sure. No, that's correct. The plain language of treaty provides that kind of protection to any state. So it's a question of whether it was proved to that extent that this was a genuine need. I think that's the debate. And only way you can bring in that is by way of the reasons behind it and the way the decision was taken, or whether this was a preempted decision for certain other actions. So that's how the evidence would have gone in terms of coming to any conclusion between whether India is able to prove that they fall under the exception, which is pretty clear and wide so far as protection of security interests is concerned, at least the essential security interests. Any other questions from the participants on the phone?
Well, no, there seems to be no response from the participants
sure.
on the phone. There are no questions.
Okay. So any other questions from the floor here? Okay. So that possibly marks the end of this session and on time end of this session, which we expected to end at about 7:30. So thank you all for joining this session and we'll be happy to provide any further inputs and our thoughts on this if any offline queries come to us over an email or otherwise. And considering the festival season in India and the holiday season's just starting over the weekend. Wish you all in advance from all of us at NDA a very, very happy Diwali and great holidays for the next week. Thank you all. Thank you.
Thank you very much. On behalf of Nishit Desai and Associates, that concludes this conference. Thank you for joining us, ladies and gentlemen. You may now disconnect your lines. Thank you.